Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair. Hello, everybody. You got Carly and Cece here today with lots of juicy stuff to talk about. You know, we should have placed a wager on if we could ever go a week without talking about AI. It was kind of a running joke for a while there. Now it is very clear that we will not ever be going a week without talking about it unless we are not recording. And it is that simple.
Yeah. I don't think anyone would have taken that bet, though.
Or they would have been like, what are these agents even talking about in terms of the modern publishing landscape? But we've got some fun things to talk about today. I'm not sure if this slipped under people's radar or not, but the New York Times has made some changes to their bestseller list, which I think we have to alert everybody to. It kind of went, as I said, I'm not sure if it went a little bit unnoticed. I think the news went live the week before Easter, so I think it slipped under the radar a little bit. And then we got, I know I got a lot of DMs about this. I'm sure you got a lot of DMs about this, which is our editors using AI internally to assess manuscripts, bookseller article. And we're going to talk about that. So we've got lots of things going on. And then we have a really interesting breakdown on Substack. 60 debut authors were involved in a survey about the breakdown of their advances and things like that, which is really juicy and interesting. So you want to pay attention through the whole episode. We got lots of good stuff going on. But Cece, I know you are making your monthly pilgrimage to New York next week. What do you have on tap for that?
Oh, gosh. I have a really fun book launch on Tuesday. I'm not going to plug it in because it's sold out, or else I totally would. But then I also have meetings, just meetings, lunches, drinks. You know how it is. And as an introvert, it's both really challenging for me, but at the same time, like really fun, because I discovered, I've said this before, that talking to book people does not drain me in the same way that talking to regular people does. Like, it's actually quite energizing and lovely. Like, I'm still tired by the end, but it's like one of those worth it tired. I imagine it feels like it's what the equivalent of going to the gym for healthy people, where you're like, you know, feeling good about yourself at the end. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know. But yeah, I have lots of fun meetings and really excited to go. How about you? What are you doing next week?
So you will be in New York. I will be in Toronto because my client Mai's book is coming out.
Yay! Cleo Dang would rather be dead. Can we talk about what a great cover that is?
It is a great cover. It is.
Oh my God, the pink and the green cover. And the yellow. Yeah. And it's like, and I know they what the book's about. It. So like tonally, it's like, it's perfect. Yeah. Like,
it's,
what a
it's
great
definitely
cover.
The Wedding People vibes, right? Where the Wedding People cover where she's kind of like going under in the water and then has her champagne glass and up in the air. It's that like this character on Cleo Dang cover is horizontal. And so you're like, is she sleeping? Is she okay? Is she just laying there? But kind of also has these bright yellow socks on and the colors are so bright and vibrant. Anyway, they nailed it. You know, with like as an agent, sometimes the covers come in and you're like, this is not the cover. But this one, they just nailed it. They did such a great job. So
was it from the first try?
Yeah.
Is it like first round?
Oh, wow. Yay. Yeah. I mean, publishers usually have things going on behind the scenes that we don't see, but this was the first one.
Right. The first one you saw. Yeah. That's exciting. Go Mai. I'm proud of her. And I'm sorry I can't go. I'm now sad.
But yeah, so the event, the actual launch event is Tuesday for everybody that's listening when this comes out live, which is Monday. So Tuesday, tomorrow, the 14th, it is an open launch. So anybody can come. So anybody who is in downtown Toronto that wants to come, Simon & Schuster Canada is asking that people RSVP, but you can go to Mai's Instagram at BYMAINGUYEN, which is like by mine win. Go to her Instagram. You can see all the information, but I will be there and it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful time. And I also made a note of what I'm reading because I feel like we don't talk enough about what we're reading just for fun right now. I grabbed Evening and Weekends. I hadn't read that one. That came out a couple of years ago, set in the UK. I'm really excited to dive into that one. And my copy of American Fantasy, Emma Straub's novel, just arrived. So that's kind of what's on my bedside TBR. What are you reading right now?
So I just started Yesteryear, which I'm really excited about. And I had yesterday, actually, a client, we were on Zoom. And this is a shared client that I have with Wendy. And our client was like, hey, so I have a new project. Actually, I have two. And like one's dystopian, one's romance. And she was like, which one should I send first? And I'm like, just send both. Like, I want to read both.
Yeah.
She made both of them sound so good. Like, not every author can pitch their own
book. Totally, pitch their own work, yeah.
Especially, like, in a casual call. Like, she didn't prepare or anything. But she was, like, she nailed the pitches. And I'm, like, really excited to read them both. So I have both of them on my Kindle. So, coin toss. I don't know which one I'm going to start. I think I'm going to probably do the women's fiction with romantic elements first. Because I actually said that wrong. It's women's fiction with romantic elements and dystopian. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm going to do, because it's nice and sunny out, you know, we're trying to make spring happen. So I think I'm going to start with that one first. I love reading on my Kindle. It's really good for the readability aspect of it, which does matter. Like, I like the feel of a book because I read an ebook so much. Yeah. Yes. So I read, and I do mean, sorry, when I say Kindle, I mean my Kindle app.
Oh, yeah.
It's Kindle app on the iPad because I have an iPad. But I read so many ebooks that to me, honestly, for like over 15 years now, most of the books I read are ebooks. And so the feel of a book for modern CC has become an ebook. And so when I'm reading on my Kindle app, I really love it. It's like so great. So I'm excited about that. And I always read in the evenings. I'm always like watching TV with my husband for like an hour in the evenings. And then I tell him, you have to go to bed early, early for us. We're a night owl because I have a lot of reading to do. So then I go to bed and I read and it's the best.
Yeah. And then you never sleep because you're always reading.
Yes.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. The problem, I can't read on an iPad. I've done the iPad thing before, but I just find that the technology piece sucks me in. It's like this app, and then you can switch to this. And I love the Kindle, the physical Kindle. I have the Scribe, which has a pen, so I can annotate. Yeah. It makes me feel like I'm in work mode, so that when I'm doing other things, I don't know, it helps compartmentalize it for me.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I wrote in our notes today, we're pretty organized today, Cece. I'm going to give us a pat on the back. I wrote in our notes today, I have some top secret news. That...
Wait, should we do drum rolls? Drum rolls for top secret news.
Okay. Number one top secret news is I have a client book that is an adaptation for television. And it's like been humming along. We're going to find out in November if it's going to be greenlit. So I know this is still a while away. And I have to wait till November. A lot of good vibes. Yeah. It's just when, you know, all the pilot season is and things like that. So everybody send me lots of good vibes because I know you all want to see my client's work brought to life on the silver screen. Yeah, fingers crossed, everybody, for that to happen. You know, we never know. I have been lucky enough to have works turned into television and movies, and you just never know. Like, I think I've talked before about the percentage of books. I think I've done like 25 options and like I've seen two things made. You know, like the odds are not great in terms of getting things done. So we're at the home stretch here. And the hard thing is so much work could go into this in terms of like the vision and everything. And then you can get to like the 11th hour and then it'll be like, nope, we're not picking this up. You're like, okay, great. Yeah. We just put, you know, tons and tons of work into this, but yeah, anyway, so everybody keep your fingers crossed for me. The second piece of top secret news that I have is that I am going to get my second client billboard in Times Square.
Oh, so yay, fun!
Those of you who've been listening for a long time know that my client Jane Healy had a billboard in Times Square for Women of Arlington Hall, which was great. It's so exciting to see.
And you got to see it. Client. And that was you shared a picture on stories, but it wasn't you. And, gotcha.
Jane drove down from Boston to see. I was honestly so tempted to get on a plane. I was like, I might actually do that for this one. I don't know. Just something like if you were an author and you were like, I have a billboard in Times Square, you're going to go see the thing.
Got to do it. Yeah.
So as the agent, I'm like, by proxy, I really want to see the thing. So I might have to go see it. But anyway, so my client, my second Times Square billboard is going to be happening. So that's really exciting. Anyway, so that's all my top secret news.
Yay. Fun. You can't tell us who yet, right?
No.
Okay. So it's top secret news and top secret curiosity seeds.
Yes. Keeping you guys listening to the pod. No. And all of you guys buy my client books anyway, so I don't have to convince you. I have excellent taste. Everyone knows.
Everyone knows.
Awesome. Okay, so should we get into what we're going to talk about today? Where do you want to start, Cece?
Well, I don't know. Should we start with the list, the New York Times list being updated?
Yeah, why don't we start with that? So, as I said, I think this flew under the radar a little bit. So, you know, it's not only that I want to talk about the announcement, I also want to talk about why the announcement was, made and how we can, give you some context and some behind the scenes potentially about what is going to be featured more than others now and how that communicates some of the different trends that are happening within the industry, the consumer marketplace. So I'm going to read from the New York Times website. Announcing updates to our bestseller lists. So they're introducing some new lists and they're, quote, better positioning others to reflect shifts in the bookselling industry, end quote. So they're basically like going to be cutting some of the lists. So here we go. So this went live on March 30th. So it said, with audiobooks making up a larger share of how people consume books, we are broadening our audio offerings by adding two new lists. Audio children's top 15 and audio advice, how to and miscellaneous top 10. I have a lot of thoughts about that. We'll come back to that. These additions round out our coverage of the audiobook segment, which currently includes audio fiction and audio nonfiction, and reflect the Times' goal to publish lists that cover different formats through which readers and increasing listeners purchase books. Second paragraph, to better align with current market trends, we will cease publication of our monthly mass market lists, and the weekly paperback nonfiction list will shift to monthly. Mass market and nonfiction paperback books will continue to be eligible to appear in the combined print and ebook lists, the overall lists. So yeah, I mean, I feel like that is kind of bombshell news, and we can get into all the layers of all of this, like what was kind of promoted above other things, what's getting canceled or, you know, demoted, obviously. Where do you want to start? Which one jumped out to you?
I mean, a lot of thoughts, like you said. I mean, my first thought was a little late to the game with the audio. Like, I'm glad they did it now. I really am like adding things. I'm glad about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, audiobooks have been kind of a thing for a while and kind of a massive thing for a while. So I would have hoped to see it, and I'm glad they did it. The thing about the New York Times list is that it's so shrouded in secrecy. Like it is not a situation. It's every author's dream. Everyone I talk to goes, yes, and my dream is to become a New York Times bestselling author. And yet people don't quite understand how the chances of getting in are very, very, very small. Like, I forget what the actual statistic is, but there was one time an article, a Greed article, that broke it down, and it was something like depressing, like 0.00 whatever.
Oh, I was going to say it's like point something, something, something. Yeah.
Lots of zeros and then a number, right? Yeah. And then, but you know, more to the point though, it's not just a numbers game as in, I don't know, like if you qualify for the Olympics, like, yeah, chances of you running that fast is 0.001, but you know if you do or if you don't, because you either run that fast or you don't.
Yeah.
In this case, it's also like, there's certain books they will consider and certain books they won't. It's curated, right? And they don't hide that fact. It's not, you know, something that people deny or anything, but I don't think people realize it that much. Like, it is not simply XYZ in sales and then you'll make the list. Also, it depends on the week and all that stuff. So I found it to be interesting. What were your thoughts?
Ooh, lots of thoughts. All of what you said is obviously true. If you're a longtime listener to our show or our socials, you know all that information about how the Times list is very heavily curated. What I think is super interesting about the audio piece, a couple things. I don't even know where to start. My brain's just buzzing. Okay, let's talk about the fact that they are creating the audio advice, how to and miscellaneous. This is essentially going to be the podcaster celebrity category, right? This isn't going to be for the kind of average person, right? Because this is going to be audio of people who have done an advice, how to a miscellaneous, which is always the kind of like influencer type of category, right? So that's obviously very important to think about. They're really just promoting things that maybe don't necessarily already need promoting. The other thing this makes me think about is, where are they getting all this audio data? Because we know that most people have a subscription to Audible, have a subscription to
Libro FM.
Libro, right? So, but Libro is supporting indies, right? Audible is obviously supporting Amazon. So I'm wondering, like, again, where they're going to pull all this data from. If it's just Libro FM, that puts a lot of pressure on that system to, you know, if you're an author listening to this and you're hearing this, I would be promoting my audiobook through Libro FM like nobody's business, because if you have that opportunity, especially obviously if you're in the how to and miscellaneous advice section. But anyway, so yeah, I think about what kind of data they're actually going to pull from.
It's a little bit the same issue we see with BookScan. Like, I'm a big fan of BookScan because I love having a database where I can go in and nerd out about statistics and figures. But when it comes to the audio numbers, because they don't capture from Audible in terms of credits, right? Like who's using what credit for what?
Yeah.
It's just so wildly inaccurate.
Yeah.
At least I assume it is. Obviously, I would need to see every royalty statement to compare it against every, and I can't do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tricky. It's
yeah.
Tricky,
sure. And so let's pivot to the second paragraph there, which is ceasing publication of the monthly mass market list and the weekly paperback nonfiction. So there's a couple things that I'm clocking here, which is less nonfiction is being turned into paperback. A lot of nonfiction is published in hardcover and sometimes never goes into a second print run, where it was used to always be that, you know, the hardcover print run would go and then they would do the paperback print run. It's not guaranteed that everything is going to be turned into paperback these days. So they're assuming you're either buying it in hardcover or you're buying it in audio, which is kind of why they're pumping up those audio lists and making that more central. The other thing is mass market. Yeah, the mass market.
I was
going to
say, I'm sad about mass market.
Yeah, for a long time, and we've reported on this. I don't know if you can call the show reporting. We have commented on this show about just the lack of support for mass market and how that has declined over the years. Yeah, so that's a bummer.
It really is. I mean, again, I will not pretend to understand the reasons behind their decision, but mass market is tied to mass readership. And yeah. I can't help but think, and I know that it's in decline. There was another New York Times article from February that talked about the decline of mass market paperback readership. And I don't know. No, thank you. Can we please have a world where we have lots of mass market? One of my favorite things to do is to talk to people who have been doing this for a lot longer than I have. Like they've been in agenting for many decades. And the stories of days where agents would get to sell paperback rights for millions of dollars, like, it sounds so great. Why wasn't I alive then? Like, I want to get a time machine. This is what I would do. This is what I would do if I had, like, a time machine situation. I would go back and be an agent in the era of...
The 90s.
Yeah. Whatever it was that people were paying millions of dollars for, like, all the rights.
Well, they used to be so separate and there was more competition. I mean, if we're going to go down the rabbit hole of going into the past, the glory days, like, I mean, having more competition to be able to sell these books to would be great. Being able to sell paperback rights, I mean, oh my gosh.
Yes, please. Glory days. Yeah, that's what I want. That's what I want. Let's just do it. Let's just get in our time machine.
This is not a fiction podcast. This is a non-fiction podcast.
Yet we are ranked on fiction on Substack.
That's true. That's true. Okay, so let's hear a word from our sponsors, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about all the juicy stuff about our editors actually putting manuscripts into AI. It's hard to believe, but it's my 10th wedding anniversary this year, and my husband and I are planning on what we want to do to celebrate. When we got married, two 20-somethings fresh out of grad school, just starting our careers, we didn't really want to invest in a big honeymoon. It felt a bit irresponsible when we wanted to buy a house and all those grown-up things, but fast forward to 2026, and my Italian husband and I are finally planning a wine tour in Italy. If you have travel coming up, join me in using Rosetta Stone to learn some local languages. There's something about spring that feels like a reset, fresh energy, and the motivation to try something new. Learning a language is the perfect way to channel that momentum into a skill that's going to open up the world. Rosetta Stone has been the trusted leader in language learning for 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb your new language without memorizing random vocabulary lists or relying on translations. Instead, you get to connect with words, visuals, and meanings in context, the way that language is meant to be learned. Working in the publishing business means my days are often packed with meetings and manuscripts, but I love how simple these lessons are and they fit into my schedule. Whether I have 5 minutes between emails or an hour on the weekend, I can access my lessons from my desktop or the mobile app. Since we're heading to Italy, I've been using the True Accent feature, which gives real-time feedback on my pronunciation so I can sound more natural when visiting the local vineyards. It's like having a personal coach help me communicate with confidence. Rosetta Stone offers 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, and Japanese. You can find the one that fits your next big adventure. Ready to start learning a new language this spring? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose a language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey. All right, everybody, welcome back. As promised, we're going to get into the bookseller article. So it came out on April 2nd. It said some editors uploading confidential manuscripts to ChatGPT to read quickly, agent claims, written by Eloise Wood and published in The Bookseller. The Bookseller is, you know, for those of you that don't know, the kind of official word of UK publishing. And so an article kind of, this is like an equivalent of something coming out in Publishers Weekly or Quill and Quire if you're in Canada. So this is, you know, considered a serious publication for book people. So this is a very serious accusation. Cece, did you get a chance to look at this one? Do you want to give broad strokes on what it said?
Sure. So, you know, the article started with Gordon Weiss, who's an agent at Curtis Brown, voicing concerns that some editors might be allegedly using ChatGPT to assess the quality of manuscripts before reading them. So they would feed the manuscripts into OpenAI to essentially like do a quality check. It also flagged how some parties, including some agents, might be feeding manuscripts into apps and software such as Speechify to listen to the submission as opposed to digesting it with their eyes ahead of reading it with their eyes, which is a little concerning. Actually, I want to clarify what I just said because I have the article open in front of me. I said some people, including agents, that's not true. The article said that editors do the Speechify thing, but I know of agents who do the Speechify thing. Which is where I got that from. Yeah. So, because I've heard from a few agents that I know, many that I love and respect and who are great, that they have fed the manuscript. Well, they've used some type of app. I actually don't know that it's Speechify, but they use some type of app.
Like a text-to-speech app.
Yes. To listen to manuscripts. Like, I've never done it. And this is, I wish I could say it was because of principled moral stance. It isn't. I never thought about the implications. I should have. I never did it. I don't like the text-to-speech apps. Yeah. Like it doesn't work for me. I like reading with my eyes when it comes to submissions. It's important to me. But yeah, so the article kind of takes us through it. And I will say it does have a very interesting point about how should agencies have AI language in their contracts? Should agencies have authors disclose whether they've used AI or not? One could argue that because so many of these contracts likely have language saying the work is original, that is implied. But, you know, in an age where everyone's been using AI, that's a little bit tricky. As well, there are some titles that you really just can't have a blanket AI clause. Like this is one of the situations where the agent has to negotiate. The article talks about an example of, for example, scientists who are writing about AI and have actually done tests in AI to write the book, right? Like they talk about how AI functions. And so, of course, they could never say that no part of that book has been
touched by
used
AI.
Using AI. Exactly. So that would not be reasonable. And I feel like, you know, this is where nuance comes in and critical thinking, and that's what's so important. But it's a really good article. I appreciated reading it a lot. How about you? What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I can't tell if just my corner of the internet or what things get sent to me are people who are just, I don't know how to say it, like in the discourse, right? They're just like, they're so online that they're just taking in so much of this content. A lot of this stuff, while I do not support, condone, or endorse, is things that I assumed that were going on. I think on this show before, I've said that I know that there are editors who used closed AI systems, like their internal AI software, to write taglines. So we've known for quite a while that editors are using in-house tools.
It is different, though, right? To use in-house versus open.
Yes, exactly, right? So I think that's a key piece. But yeah, I don't know. As I said, I can't tell if it's just like what corner of the internet is kind of up in arms about things. I just want to quote Agent Gordon Wise from the article. He said, "In the same way we ask our clients to tell us if any AI was used in the course of writing their work, we expect transparency from publishers too. Editors uploading confidential manuscripts into ChatGPT or other open AI platforms in order to help them, quote, read, end quote, books quickly is not responsible behavior, given the security risks involved in handing over such property to a third party. But disturbingly, conversations over the course of London Book Fair have indicated that this seems to have become a widely adopted practice," end quote. So
it's really surprising to me, to be honest, that they would use open. It was because I felt that people would be afraid of their jobs. Like, like if I'm an editor working, like, again, I'm thinking about it from a selfish perspective, not like a moral perspective. If I'm an editor working at a publisher, I don't want to put my job in jeopardy and open up myself and the publisher to liability. I would not want to feed it to OpenAI. Again, it is different if it's a closed program. I'm not saying that's always okay. I'm saying that it's just such a different category that this is not the same conversation. But I don't know. I think I would be scared of losing my job, of liability, wouldn't you? Like, I think everyone would. But I'm paranoid. Yeah.
No, it's one of those things where it's like the erosion of our sensibilities and our anger towards this software and just technology in general has changed over time, because we've just accepted so much of it, right? Whether it's we know that, you know, that things are tracking us on our computers all the time. I forget the word, right?
But it's it's true.
How ads follow us around. There's a word for this, but you know how ads follow us around wherever we go on the internet.
We say something and then an ad shows up.
Yes.
Like, this has happened to me multiple times and to everyone I know. Like, we talk about things and things show up.
Yes. This footprint follows us around on the internet, right? Yeah. We know this. This is like confirmed information. And I think over time, we've just become less angry about it. And I don't know why we just continue to accept how software and technology in general has just taken over our lives. And so people are just, and because there's such a blend of our work-life, quote-unquote, balance these days, right? A lot of people use the same software for home as they do for work, right? Like, people used to have, like, oh, your work computer was at work and it wasn't a laptop. You didn't take it home. A lot of people, right, you're taking your software and hardware back and forth with you because you have to do work at home. You know, people are in hybrid work environments. So this blur between the work and the home and the work and the self is really just non-existent. You know, people such as you and me, right? We use our social media for both things. We use all of our computers for all of this stuff. So I think people have just, unfortunately, become less angry about this. And it's just, it's really unfortunate that we're just accepting how technology has just taken over our lives. And people think, well, if I could read faster, if I can review manuscripts faster, then is that just a net benefit? And I'm going to have to weigh that moral difference in my mind. But anyway.
Yeah. It's really sad, and I agree with you. At the same time, it's very unsurprising that people aren't more angry. I think because we are addicted to the technology, and addicts tend to just accept new realities as long as they can keep getting the dopamine hit that comes with the thing they're addicted to. And it is an addiction. Like, I have been trying to do this thing where I leave my phone in another room and I literally feel the withdrawal. Like, it is.
Oh, yeah.
I do not like that. And it's still true. And at the same time, like, I can't dissociate myself from my phone entirely because so much of my work life is on my phone. Like, try to do anything without a two-factor authentication system that's usually tied to your phone. Try to, you know, live without apps. Like, it's just really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, yes, a convenience, you know, need for work, but there's also, again, the addiction piece, which is even sadder.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's something that we're just gonna have to continue to wrestle with in different ways. And yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, obviously we talked about the kind of AI book cancellation scandal last week, but, you know, if there is an editor using AI to review submissions scandal, like, are we really going to hear about it? Or is it just going to be somebody's fired or they're just reprimanded, or depending on the level that they're at within the publishing house, what are the consequences, right? And I think that's what this agent is mad about, or not mad. I'm obviously totally speaking for them, but I think why the agent is raising concerns about this, right? It's like, as agents, how do we know what editors are doing with our clients' work? We don't know.
100%. And I wonder what their contracts say, you know, like their employment contracts. Like, I wonder if there's language preventing them from, and I'm sure there's like confidentiality language, et cetera. But like, I wonder if there are specific references to use of AI and unauthorized platforms. I also wonder what it's going to be like for the younger generation. Like, one of the things that does keep publishing going and that is so important is hiring new talent, younger people who know what younger
full
people
of energy
want to read. Yeah, and also, like, who understand what people want to read, you know? Like, you know this, like, one of the best things about getting, like, a reader's report from, like, an intern or an assistant who's younger is I'm not only getting my millennial perspective, but I'm getting their Gen Z perspective. I'm pretty sure it's going to be, like, Gen Alpha, right? Because, like, Gen Alpha is getting old enough to pretty soon be a part of the workforce. So I just feel like it's interesting because what I've observed is that more and more. So here's what I'm trying to say. I remember when the internet became a thing. I was really young, but I remember. And I sort of remember a world without it, but I can't live without it, right? So pretty soon this is going to happen with AI. Like, there's going to be a whole generation that's like, yeah, I remember life before AI, but I don't. Like, not for the purposes of knowing how to live without it. And, you know, what's going to happen then? I don't know.
I think the issue is it's just integrated into everything. And I think this was I wrote up my Substack about all of this happening. Obviously, we see your comments on YouTube and all of this. I think one of the issues that kept coming up in all of the comments and captions and things that you guys were responding to was this idea of AI is integrated into everything. Like, there's no app that's like, we're not using AI. It's like, here's how to AI-ify, literally every app that we use. And so how can we actually say, so I'm talking about editors, right, in their work life. Like, how can we actually say that and no part of any workflow of anything that they touch is being used by these things, right? And a lot of the AI author contracts have an AI clause in them, which said, like, in the publishers negotiate for them to protect themselves, for their employees to be able to use some sort of internal system. So it's not that you can write in an author contract that nothing will be ever touched by AI, because that is just not a reality, and that's not what the contracts look like.
100%. It's so complicated. Like, life has been getting more and more complicated.
I know. So there was a really good podcast episode by Money Feels, and they had a really good episode about how to reduce your screen time that came out in early April. It was like an hour and a half long episode, and so many things about, like, how can we just make technology a little bit harder, right? Like, how do we just resist a little bit more? And so I don't have Threads on my phone. I have to go to my computer for Threads. I don't have Substack on my phone. I have to go to my computer for Substack. So anything like that, which is not directly tied to work, but kind of tied to work, I just don't have it on my phone. I don't have any notifications on. Yeah.
Have you ever read Dopamine Nation?
No, I haven't.
It's actually really interesting because the author talks about multiple types of addiction, especially addiction. Because what happens in the world when you're addicted, when like the thing is so readily available, which is our world, right? And she actually became curious about it from a personal perspective, like her experience with addiction, because of, wait for it, books. She became addicted to romance novels. And I remember being like, this is not a real addiction. My first shameful reaction. And then, no, she actually did. She went through her process, and I'm 1,000% convinced, and I feel so embarrassed that I had that reaction, but I did, and I want to own up to it. She did become addicted to it. And one of the things she talks about is how one of the ways to combat the plentiful supply of all the things we could ever possibly want in our world, and how we become addicted to dopamine, I don't think that's actually medically accurate, but whatever, is to make things harder, is to do what you're saying, like keep the threads.
Great friction.
Yeah, exactly. Create just more make friction. It a little bit inconvenient because the fact that the supply, like if you are addicted, for example, to romance novels, the fact that you have a Kindle, you know, and you can buy books anytime, you don't actually have to go to the bookstore. You know, makes it harder to not fall prey to the addiction. And even as I say this, there's a giant voice inside my mind going, stop telling people to not buy books. I'm not saying that. People, please buy all the books. But you don't have to read them. Feed the authors paychecks. But then you don't have to read them if you have a problem. But still buy all the books. Please buy all the books.
Buy them as gifts. Buy them as gifts. There are so many ways around this.
Buy them as
gifts.
Buy them as artwork for your bookshelf. Pretty guys.
Home decor. It's home decor. Yeah. It's anything you want it to be. All right. Well, that's kind of all we can say on that topic for today. But I'm sure next week there'll be another article making the rounds. And we always have our eye out for that sort of thing. All right. The last thing on our list today was a Substack post. I don't even know how this came across my desk. But there is a Substack from an author named Emily Zips, with a Z, Z-I-P-P-S, Emily Zips, who did some surveying of 2025 debut authors. And so what they did was they did a survey of 60 people. So we're totally, you know, acknowledging it's not a massive sample size, but there's a lot of interesting information here. So 60 people who had their debut book traditionally published in the year 2025. And so there's a part one to this data and a part two to the data. So we are doing part two of the data, and this Substack came out on January 28th. Yeah, so Cece, you said you hadn't came across this one. What did you think when I posted it in the doc?
You sent it to me, and I thought it was so well written. Like, Emily Zips, I am not familiar with you, but now I'm going to look you up and become a fan. No, this was very good. Everything was broken down in a very clear way. I like that she started right away with the number one question everyone has. Like, okay, so you surveyed 60 debut authors, you know, people who debuted in 2025. And the first question was like, how much money do people make? And so, you know, one of the figures showed the like a pie chart with the levels of advances. So for example, and I, you know, I encourage everyone to look at the Substack. I'm not going to read up all of them. You should look at this pie chart. But for example, no advance, meaning an advance of $0, came out to 20% of those 60 people. And an advance of $100,000 to $250,000, also known as like a good deal in publishing, came to 15%. Now, this is where it gets interesting. There's a second pie chart in which Emily says, okay, but that's not super accurate because some books are 2-book deal, 3-book deals, 4-book deals. So you actually have to look at the advance per book, right?
Yeah.
And then the number changes significantly. No advance is still 20%, but the second number I read, so 100,000 to 250,000 advance, goes from 15% to 8%. So, you know, it does matter. The per book does matter. And I'm really just highlighting this one detail in the article because there's so much more data to say how thoughtful and how interesting this analysis was. And like 100%, 60 people is not a large sample size when you consider the millions of books that were published in 2025. But hey, it's someone crunching data in a really interesting, smart way. So I personally loved it. I'm going to subscribe to this and start reading the Substack. I'm excited.
Yeah. No, I thought it was an excellent, excellent breakdown. A couple of things I wanted to highlight, which you guys might have questions about, which is where are these people from? So 60% of these respondents were from the United States and 17% was from the UK. That matters because American advances are much larger than UK advances just based on population size and market size. So that is something to pay attention to. And then you're probably wondering, what is the size of these publishers? 42% of these debuts were with big fives. A large subset were with, I think they call them just like smaller presses, which is why you're seeing that $0 number kind of, you know, pull down that to that 20% of people were $0. Small presses, people don't offer advances, sometimes just royalties. So this, you know, sample size of 60 people is obviously varied. I think she said in this, correct me if I'm wrong, but there were no kind of like mid-range, like mid-size publishers. It was either small independents or big fives, just based on the people that did the survey. So anyway, lots of interesting, and I'm sure people are wondering, you know, the big advances, how many people got big advances? It was essentially one person of the 60, if you do the breakdown of the math. So it was of a multi-book deal who was over 500K, 2% of the 60, which is essentially one person. So just fun facts for everybody there.
Yeah. The fact that the only houses offering the $0 advance were big five or small indies says a lot to me, I think.
I'm assuming it's the indies.
I mean, yes and no, because if you think about the digital first imprints of some big fives, right? They sometimes do. Like, for example, if you do Book Couture, is that Hachette? Because that's a big five.
Technically, yes.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, is that how it counts? So then, yes. It would be like that's an example.
It would be a Hachette contract, I assume. Yeah.
I mean, I assume, and so so that would be a $0 advance situation. So
interesting.
And it would be not a small indie press. Although, again, digital, it just,
it is traditional. Yeah. It is technically big five, but it's not, it's digital first. Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, loopholes and things that we won't know. But I think you guys will really, really like that. So definitely go check it out. If you want to know more about data, she breaks down like race of the characters. Are there queer characters? All of the diversity representation is also in this. So if you're curious about that breakdown, head over to Emily's Substack.
Yes, that was great.
That was great. That's everything we have for today, guys. So we look forward to hearing what you think about it. You obviously know where to find us. We love hearing from you on YouTube. So you know where to drop things in the comments below. Thanks for hanging out with us for another week.
CC Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query CC, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.